Next case, please.
The third case this morning is A22-1160, Douglas Kemp, appellant versus State Farm Insurance Company, respondent.
Mr. Keene, were you trying to get away with a glass?
Here, let me help you.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing it back. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You see that you can either use the podium next to your table or the one in the middle, which goes up and down. At the beginning of your argument, please state your name for the record. And you'll each have 15 minutes, 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use it. So with that, attorney for appellant, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Gillespie, and I represent Mr. Kemp. I'll be referring to him as Mr. Kemp, and I'll be referring to the respondent as State Farm in my argument. At a fundamental level, very fundamental level, this case requires the court to determine if the parties intended to put one over here on State Farm or to resolve that portion of the case that existed as it was at that particular point in time back in 2019. What I mean by that is Mr. Kemp had certain damages up to that point in time, but he had ongoing losses, and it was clear that he had more ongoing losses even after the arbitration was done. So was the intent to preserve the right to pursue those ongoing losses later, or was it a failed attempt to put one over on State Farm by creating a situation where hopefully the arbitrator would award some astronomical number, then State Farm would be stuck with it, because under Mulman, they claim they had notice, and that notice, therefore, would bind them
to... Just a minute. Could you stop the clock, please? We are being joined by some high school students.
Oh, welcome. Why don't you grab my briefcase there? I'll get it out of your way. Thank you very much.
And I think we have at least one attorney for the next case. Is that right? And we have a student, another student observer. I think I'm going to have you all come, and if it's okay with the attorneys, just sit in the inside the bar. So,
there's benches right here.
Come on, you guys. Okay. These are from the big boys. Come on. I guess I'm a
best seat
too
in the house.
Your Honor. I'm sorry. Grab a seat there.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Judge Riley.
Yeah.
Thank you, Attorney.
Have a seat.
Okay, I think we're filled up front.
Let me get that out of your way. Does the court want to just say anything to these students or not, or should we just go on?
So, well, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're in the third of four oral arguments today. This is a case about insurance coverage, and we have two fine attorneys that you'll get to watch and welcome. So let's start the clock again then.
All right. As I said, Your Honor, at a fundamental level, this is about whether the parties intended to decide the damages up to that point in time, knowing there'd be future damages, or whether they decided, or there was a failed attempt, I should say, to put one over on State Farm and stick them with a no-fault or uninsured motorist award against them that they had no base, that they didn't chance to litigate.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what paragraph one of the stipulation to arbitration, the settle claim, means. And that's where you and the drivers of the other car, your client, understand that they have a constitutional right to a trial by jury, but waive that right in favor of binding arbitration. So it seems like you substituted arbitration for a jury trial. If you had had a jury trial instead, would we be here?
No. I mean, a jury trial would have, the great thing about arbitration and a contract here is we get to decide what issues we want the arbitrator to decide. In a jury trial, like in the
well, that brings me
Butzer
to paragraph
case.
7, which okay. says the arbitrator shall be the sole judge of all the issues of law and fact.
Correct, that for this arbitration. There's no, we don't get to decide anything else. The arbitrator decides everything. But paragraph 3 says the most the arbitrator can award are policy limits against each individual defendant. Tortfeasor, I should say.
So the arbitration award included past medical expenses, past wages and loss, past pain and suffering, future medical expenses, future wages or loss of earning capacity, and future pain and suffering. There wasn't much more that could be decided.
Well, Your Honor, it's always easier to receive past wage loss in the past when it's been past rather than in the future. The future is inherently speculative. So the next case, when we're back in district court on this same matter, is I'm sure they're going to say you've already been compensated for your future wage loss, and we'll say no, we haven't, because our future wage loss far exceeds what was awarded here.
Well, go ahead. I'm struggling with how you framed the issue, to be honest with
All right.
you, because what I read in the briefs was that this is a question about whether you had entered into a settlement with the tortfeasors or whether this was a, for all intents and purposes, this arbitration became the jury trial, right? Because it was the issues of damage and I guess liability, both at-fault drivers admitted that they were at fault, right? So the only issue that the issues that the arbitrator decided were all about damages arising from these two motor vehicle accidents, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you understand that an underinsured motorist carrier has an inchoate subrogation right to be advised about how their insured is deciding to resolve their tort claims, right?
And the question is how, what kind of notifications did they receive?
Well, and I think you're taking the position that you view that this arbitration proceeding was in effect a settlement.
The arbitration agreement was a settlement procedure to resolve to settle the claims against the tortfeasors. Yes.
And so, if that's true, then the Schmidt case, which has been around forever, gave State Farm the right to step in and say, "We want to prevent you from settling this." Because we think that at-fault driver may have more resources than, in this case, his insurance policy limits. But, I mean, Schmidt contemplates an actual dollar amount that the underinsured motorist carrier would then decide whether it wanted to substitute its own check for. We don't have that situation here at all,
No,
do we?
No, we have a potential situation that's much more ripe for abuse, Your Honor, in the Melman situation. Because in Melman, if the arbitrator awards something and they have notice, they're stuck with what, no matter what it is. So in the worst possible scenario, we have a situation where we have Mr. Tortfeasor with $30,000 in coverage. We have that claimant with $100,000 in damages.
But that's not what happened here.
No, that's the next case, Your Honor.
Stankey had $250,000, but the arbitrator said $34,000, and Hassan had $50,000. Arbitrator said damage is a little shy of $19,000.
Right. So that's not what happened here. I mean, but that doesn't indicate what the intent of the parties was when they entered into the agreement.
Well, the intent of the parties. Isn't the May 2019 letter that sent to State Farm says, we're going to go ahead with arbitration on our tort claims against these two at-fault drivers, what we believe to be the at-fault drivers. If you want to participate to protect your inchoate subrogation rights, you can do that.
Well, it's not quite that specific, Your Honor.
Well,
I'm looking at the letter.
I think they invited them to join us as a party in the arbitration.
That's correct.
So isn't that exactly what the Melman notice is?
No. Yeah, I'm sorry. With all due respect, I apologize, Your Honor. It means to be so abrupt. Not at all. A mailman notice has to have the same basic reasoning as a Schmidt notice. In each instance, you want to give the insurer, the underinsured, the information sufficient to let it know whether it has to intervene to protect its interests or not. That's what a Schmidt notice requires. If I would have said...
The Schmidt notice allows them to prevent the settlement by saying, don't take their $20,000, take our check. We're going after the tortfeasor because we think they've got more money.
But a proper Schmidt notice, Your Honor, requires name of the insurer, policy limits, the amount of the settlement, who the parties are, so that allows the underinsurer to investigate. It also tells them what they have to do to protect their rights. None of that in this letter here.
Let me ask you this. Why doesn't Butser control this case?
Because Butser is a situation that assumes the arbitration agreement created the same issues as the next underinsured motorist case. Butser was not an arbitration like this one, where the parties agreed to have a settlement agreement and then we're going to have an arbitration. Butser was a situation where they were required under law to arbitrate an uninsured motorist claim first. So they didn't get to control the issues that the arbitrator arbitrated, like this situation here.
So help us understand how the issues would be different if this case were to go forward, different than those decided in the arbitration. That's what I'm having trouble identifying. I don't see that explained in your brief.
If the case were to go forward, Mr. Kemp would present the same evidence he's presented in three other no-fault arbitrations since this arbitration here, in which he showed his wage loss was ongoing, not compensated from the earlier matter, and is entitled to additional wage loss. He's won three no-fault arbitrations, but they're only $500 per week of loss, and he's lost a lot more than that per week.
Wasn't that already decided, though? I thought wage loss was part of the arbitration award.
No, wage loss was included in the arbitration award, but the arbitration award wouldn't be binding
in the next case. But how does it become a different issue?
Because time has passed, and future wage loss becomes past wage loss, and it becomes much more crystal clear what future and past are, because the past has happened, and therefore we can tell he's lost X dollars since that time.
But tort law, I mean, you don't get to go back. If this case had been decided by a jury back in 2019, and your client continued to have wage loss, they couldn't go back and start another lawsuit, could they?
No, because a jury trial isn't controlled by the parties. The parties don't get to decide what the jury decides. The law decides the issues that are for the jury, not the parties. Here, we made an agreement. We made a deal that you, Mr. Arbitrator, get to decide these issues, just these issues, not any other issues. And that's the limit of his authority.
But did it fully resolve the pending tort action? I mean, wasn't a judgment dismissing the tort action entered as a result of this arbitration award?
After the parties entered into releases based on this arbitration, which you wouldn't do if there was a trial. In a jury trial, you get a satisfaction of the judgment, and that's the end of it. In this situation, we had releases. We had negotiations, actually, during the releases to make sure that the uninsured and no-fault claims were reserved, and the parties agreed to reserve those issues in their releases. The legal aspect of the case turns on the intent of the parties here. It's clear that whether the parties intended a Malman-type settlement or a Schmidt-type settlement is the issue here.
Well, Malman's not a settlement. It's a question about whether the notice was of the fact that the case that UIM carrier may have an interest in is going to go to a fact finder, in this case an arbitrator, versus Schmidt, which is we're taking this amount of money to settle this case unless you decide to intervene.
Well, in both cases, I mean, in my view, the Malman notice should be a more specific than the Schmidt notice, because the Malman notice has more substantial consequences to an insurer than does Schmidt. If the Schmidt insurer just ignores the notice, the worst that happens is The claimant takes the money that's being offered, but the uninsured motorist carrier can still litigate and defend against the damages that they're entitled to pay. In the Malman case, they're stuck. Once the arbitrator decides X dollars, they don't have a defense anymore. They're quite required to pay the X dollars, and that's the end of it. So ignoring a Malman notice has much more severe consequences, and in fact, is much more ripe for abuse in my view.
So only the insurer is bound by the Malman, but not the claimant, the insured who.
The claimant would be as well, Your Honor, but that's not.
So why is your client not bound by the arbitrator's determination of damages?
Because the parties didn't agree to that consequence. To be honest with you, the parties agreed to the consequence that these matters will be a settlement. This amount would be a settlement of claims against the tortfeasors, not a settlement of all claims. And it was not intended by the parties when they gave the arbitrator his authority that he would decide all issues, and those would be binding on the uninsured motorist carrier or the claimant, for that matter. We decide what the authority of the arbitrator is, unlike in a judicial situation or other situations. We get to pick what they have to decide. And we decided that they don't get to have the benefit of that outcome. The contract itself in Clause 3 specifically says that the highest that can be awarded are policy limits. So he couldn't have awarded more than policy limits, so there's no way that the uninsured motorist carrier could ever be implicated by this award, because the most you can get are policy limits. That's what the intent of the parties was, to limit it to this situation.
Well, limit the recovery from the parties that were involved in that.
It's almost
arbitration.
Like a Schmidt situation where the arbitrator said, this is the amount you're going to get from these claimants. That's your settlement amount. Live with it. And that's what I've decided. And that's what we authorized him to decide. We didn't authorize him to decide the total damage of the case, just what is the amount that you will get from each of these claimants. And we get to decide that because under the case law, the parties can decide how they're going to structure their settlement. We're free to contract any way we want to. And we could have said, flip a coin, and that's the outcome. Or whatever you want to do. That's what our settlement amount is going to be against these claimants. And that's all we authorize them to do. I see I'm down to 10 seconds, so unless the court has anything more to offer or anything more of me right now, I'll reserve my rebuttal time.
Thank you, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kimberly Hoffman, and I'm here today on behalf of Respondent State Farm. The sole issue in this case is whether or not the four elements of collateral estoppel have been met so that appellant's claim for damages arising out of the September 2016 accident have already been resolved. In this case, the four elements of collateral estoppel are all met, and so appellant is precluded from relitigating the issue of his damages against State Farm. And I'd like to start by just addressing some of the issues that were raised by appellant. And the first is that the issue of future damages, that those have changed since this arbitration, and therefore that somehow makes the issues different. Future damages were already decided, past and future. In a jury trial, after an arbitration, after any sort of judgment, a claimant cannot come back and say, okay, well, now my damages have changed. You get one shot at the apple, kind of with a negligence claim.
But Mr. Gillespie says that, in fact, the parties to this agreement specifically agreed otherwise, that, in fact, Mr. Kemp would be able to come back and seek additional damages, future damages that weren't covered by the arbitration award.
And that is just simply not the case. If you read the arbitration agreement at paragraph 3, it talks about following the hearing what kind of money will be awarded. But if you read the agreement at paragraphs 4 and 5, the agreement specifically contemplates the arbitrator awarding anywhere from $0 damages to infinity. The last sentences of paragraphs 4 and 5 in the agreement, they're pretty identical. They just speak to the two different tortfeasors. But they contemplate if the arbitrator's award is more than $250,000 or more than $50,000, if it's more than the tortfeasor's policy limits. So the arbitrator was not, in fact, limited to awarding just the policy limits. Paragraph 3 talks about, okay, after the arbitrator has heard and decided and made a judgment as to the damages in this case, what will happen after that?
What does paragraph 14 mean?
And so that does, paragraph 14 and 13, for that matter, both talk about the Schmidt versus Clothier notice. And in this case, that is as in Butzer. Butzer talks about you have that language in this type of agreement, but it really doesn't have any legal relevance to what the parties were agreeing to or deciding in this case. This agreement here, the arbitration agreement, was between the tortfeasors and between Mr. Kemp. It in no way involved State Farm, the underinsured carrier, and so it really can't speak to, this agreement can't speak to what is going to be the underinsured claim after that.
Is there any question under the agreement that the parties would be bound and a judgment in accord with the arbitrator's decision would be entered in the district court?
In the district court, the agreement doesn't speak to that necessarily, but the arbitration agreement itself does say at paragraph 7 that the arbitrator shall be the sole judge of all the issues of law and fact. And then it also, at another point, and that is at, let me find the paragraph number here. Well, it's at paragraph 4 and 5 again. It does speak to the award. It states the award shall be final and binding. So it does have that language saying this is going to be a judgment, this is going to be permanent. And then
is there at least a fact question as to that, though, given that the document is entitled Stipulation to Arbitration to Settle Claim, and then there's, you know, references to the Schmidt letter?
And so with that, and I know this issue came up in appellant's reply brief about the ambiguity of the possible ambiguity of this agreement. Ultimately, I don't think that matters, and those things don't speak necessarily to the full intent of the parties. And so the situation is similar to as in Butzer, as to Strong, as to George, where the courts did consider all of these different types of factors. And so while those things, you know, it does say settlement to arbitrate, if you go back to the Kubel case as well, the court in that case stated that an insured must characterize an arbitration award as either a settlement or a conclusion of a tort action and may not rely on both characterizations when pursuing UIM benefits. And so you do have to look at what was the intent of the parties. What does this arbitration agreement say? You do have to look at all of the factors, and you can't have an appellant trying to play it both ways. I think the title of the document, if anything, shows that, it's arbitration to settle. It contains both of those phrases. I think it shows that appellant was trying to maybe somewhat be intentionally ambiguous, which you just can't do according to Kubel. And if you go back to even the George case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, they note that the kind of the default is that an arbitration is intended to be a judgment. It's intended to be binding and final. And they say it's an unorthodox situation where it's going to be looked at as a settlement agreement. And then the George case puts forth very specifics of what you would include in the arbitration agreement if you wanted it to be considered a settlement, if you wanted to go away from that default rule as set forth in Butzer. And you just simply don't have that same language in the arbitration agreement here that you had in George. So in George, the court specifically notes that the arbitration agreement said that the payment due following the arbitration would be tantamount to a settlement offer. You don't have that language in this case.
But we have this reference to a precautionary Schmidt letter. Is there some case law that I'm not aware of that defines a, suggests what a precautionary Schmidt letter might be?
And I think that is just the Schmidt letter or the Schmidt, the same notice. I think people kind of, I think the phrase precautionary is put in there just because it's kind of, okay, you're giving notice. I can't say why the word precautionary was used specifically in this agreement, but I think my understanding is that it's just a general reference to your kind of your standard Schmidt notice. But again, as in Butzer, that kind of same language was contained in Butzer, and the court just said it had no legal relevance to deciding the issues in that case and to this case. And again, a Schmidt notice is between the underinsured carrier and the injured plaintiff. The agreement that we're looking at is between the tortfeasors and the injured plaintiff. And so the Schmidt analysis just, the Schmidt reference in the arbitration agreement just doesn't have any legal effect, as the court noted in Butzer. It just simply cannot have any legal effect because it's not for necessarily the tortfeasors to say, you know, the effect that this will have on the subsequent underinsured claim. And so again, going back to what is contained in George, where the court sets out the roadmap of if you want to go away from this default rule of an arbitration be considered a judgment, the Minnesota Supreme Court said in George, you've got to have these types of things. And again, the agreement in this case just doesn't have that same language that you have in George. So going through, like I said, the issue in this case is really, does collateral estoppel apply? Are those four factors for collateral estoppel met? And I'd like to address each of those just briefly. I'm going to kind of start out of order with the least contentious. The third factor is whether or not the estopped party, which in this case would be Mr. Kemp, was a party to the prior adjudication. And this factor is simply met. Appellant Kemp in the reply brief kind of seemed to insinuate for the first time that he was not a party to the prior arbitration because it was just his attorney who signed the arbitration agreement. And that was, again, raised for the first time in appellant's reply brief. But I think that's not seriously in contention, and it's just illogical to say that he wasn't a party to this arbitration or to the arbitration agreement. Again, going out of order, that fourth factor of collateral estoppel is the estopped party received a full and fair opportunity to be heard on the adjudicated issue. I think that factor is met here as well, and that's not seriously in contention. Some of the things the court noted in Butzer is things like, was the party represented by counsel, which Mr. Kemp was represented by his same counsel as to this case in the arbitration. The arbitration agreement also called for things like discovery under the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, which is further evidence that they had a full and fair opportunity to be heard. Plaintiff testified during his, or Mr. Kemp testified during his deposition in this matter, that he was able to appear at that arbitration and hearing. He had a chance to testify. So again, that speaks to this fourth factor and shows that it is met. The first issue of collateral estoppel, or the first factor, is whether the issue to be addressed is identical to an issue in a prior adjudication. And that seems to be kind of the first contentious issue, at least from appellant's perspective. Appellant states in their initial brief that the arbitrator wasn't supposed to decide the underinsured claim against State Farm. But that is a res judicata argument, a claim preclusion argument, whereas we're looking at collateral estoppel issue preclusion in this case. In appellant's reply brief, they then state that it has not been established that the parties intended the arbitration conducted to determine the total damages suffered by appellant. Again, I think I addressed that earlier. The arbitration agreement definitely did have the arbitrator decide all of appellant's damages from the September 2016 accident. If you look at Arbitrator Kaplan's award, which is contained in the record, he thoroughly considered past damages, future damages, for every type of category that could be considered and submitted to a jury. He also even went beyond that and did things and accounted for collateral source offsets, comparative faults, although that wasn't an issue in this case, but he did fully decide all the issues as to damages under Minnesota law. And so again, I think that first factor of collateral estoppel is met. And then the final factor I'd like to address is the second factor of collateral estoppel, the second of the fourth factor. And that was, again, whether there was a final judgment on the merits in the prior adjudication. And again, if you go back to Butzer, I think this case is controlled by Butzer. It tracks very well with both the law and the facts. And the default rule set forth in that case, it says the default is that an arbitration is meant to be a final judgment of both law and fact. And that is what you had here with that arbitration proceeding. So given that all the elements of collateral estoppel are met, this precludes appellant's claim against State Farm. He cannot relitigate the issue of his damages. And so while it's collateral estoppel issue preclusion, that does by default prevent appellant's entire claim against State Farm since that issue has been decided. And so we would ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gillespie, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to address Ms. Hoffman's argument about collateral estoppel.
Be glad to, Your Honor. We have agreement here that three experienced lawyers negotiated and signed off on. And it would have been nice if one of those three experienced lawyers would have indicated whether this is intended to be a Malman sort of a settlement that would include claims for underinsured motorist benefits, and therefore it would be an identical situation to the case, or identical issue to the case present before the district court, or whether they would have said something else. They did say Schmidt, which Schmidt seems to imply that it wasn't an identical issue to the issue before the district court, that is the liability or the amount of underinsured benefits that should be awarded, because Schmidt seems to imply that you only have a settlement against those tortfeasors that you're negotiating with, not an overall judgment as to the amount of everything that's there. So that's why Butzer doesn't apply here, because it's not the identical issue. And it's not the identical issue because in this settlement agreement, they said it was an identical issue. They got to decide what it was, and they said it wasn't. And to the extent that the contract isn't clear, you can certainly look at the behavior of the parties afterwards, and they all seem to indicate that they thought the issue of underinsured benefits was reserved for future adjudication. You have the settlement agreements that they all entered into, and you should even have some letters where they negotiated with a State Farm lawyer to say, let's make sure we specifically reserve the underinsured motorist issue for the future.
That doesn't mean you can prove it, though, right? I mean, isn't the fact that you have a fact finder who has decided that the extent of your client's damages were less than the tortfeasor's liability limits, then under the law and under State Farm's policy, that tort driver, Mr. Hassan, was not underinsured. So you can make the claim, but I don't understand why your client, who litigated the issue of his damages, isn't bound by the decision that was reached conclusively by the arbitrator on the question of damages.
Because the arbitrator's authority was not to decide all damages. The arbitrator's authority.
But the arbitrator did. I mean, the agreement says we give all the issues of law and fact to the arbitrator. Arbitrator made findings with respect to future damages, right?
Yes.
And you didn't go to district court and try to set it aside saying the arbitrator exceeded the scope of his, I mean, so.
No, that's true. We did not.
Right. So then they are decided, right?
No, the arbitrator decided only issues that were within his realm of decision. And to the extent that he exceeded his authority, There's no intent for the parties to be bound by that. Now, none of the parties objected, admittedly, whether it was the insurers or the claimant, and said, we shouldn't pay this because it's not within the arbitrator's authority. And had the insurers thought that it wasn't within the arbitrator's authority, they were certainly welcome to go back to the district court and say the same thing, that it wasn't the arbitrator's authority, and therefore we shouldn't have to pay this amount in settlement of the claims against our clients. But that's not what happened here. What happened here was that the parties had an agreement. The agreement may not be as crystal clear as I would have liked, given the fact you had three experienced lawyers. You'd like to think that they would be a little more precise than that and all signed off on this agreement. Well, you have at least their behavior afterwards, which indicates what they thought the agreement said. And that certainly bears on what the court should do with this agreement and decide what the parties intended here. And that's what the issue is for the court, the narrow legal issues. What was the intent of the parties? If the parties intended this to be a settlement only against the defendants, then it's not the identical issue, and collateral estoppel doesn't apply. Butzer's statement that the Schmidt...
Isn't that really claim preclusion, though, not issue preclusion?
It would be claim preclusion, yes, Your Honor.
But your collateral estoppel is issue preclusion.
That seems to be the use that Butzer uses, and that's, I think, what the shorthand is the parties have adopted here. But strictly speaking, you're right. The court would say it'd be claim preclusion if you wanted to be more precise than Butzer was.
But doesn't collateral estoppel apply because there is issue preclusion here?
Collateral estoppel would apply if there was issue preclusion, but there isn't issue preclusion here because it's not identical issues. The issues are not identical because...
Would you agree, though, that if we conclude the issues are identical, that collateral estoppel properly applies?
If the issues are identical, then collateral estoppel properly applies, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time, but I stepped out of line and answered the question. I apologize to the court.
Thank you. The case is submitted.